Hello there, and thank you for downloading the Agendas podcast from the 1st of June. And on the programme today, as Abu Dhabi marks the one-year anniversary of the plastic bag ban, we spoke to adventurer and extreme rower Toby Gregory about his new drive to encourage people to take the plastic pledge to protect our oceans. We also caught up with one fashion designer who's repurposing waste in her stylish clothes designs. And we were joined by Dubai's Road and Transport Authority, who've published their plan to achieve net zero emission public transport by 2050. Meanwhile, exciting new plans have been announced for the Palm Jebel Ali mega project, including 80 hotels and resorts. We discussed the details with development expert Chris Seymour. And Jordanian Crown Prince Hussein is getting married today, and the entire Arab world has wedding fever. Oman-based journalist Osama Al-Sharif talked us through why the marriage is important for the stability of the region. Plus, the team from Dubai Calendar told us what we can get up to this summer while staying out of the sun. And Sonal Rapani, the presenter of the tech show The Reboot here on Dubai Eye 103.8, came in to describe how AI is helping in the development of personalized medicines. Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. Georgia Tolley here. It has already been 1 year since Abu Dhabi banned plastic bags. Now, other Emirates quickly followed suit. You might remember in January this year, there was a federal announcement that single-use plastic bags would be banned across the Emirates. That's from next January. Plus, from 2026, and this is where it gets really interesting, from 2026, all single plastic items like cutlery, cups, lids, plates, food containers and boxes will also be prohibited. Intriguingly, in the press release, they suggested that it's, and I'm quoting here, everything from food packaging, cotton sticks. Those are the things you use in your ears? I don't want those to go. I need them for like makeup and things. Anyway, cigarette butts, wet wipes, balloons and balloon sticks, which sounds niche, but fair enough. They're all included in the strategy as well. Now, if we just take a step back and look at how big the problem is, 11 billion with a B plastic bags are used annually in the UAE. Apparently that is way more than the sort of international average, which is intriguing. But the latest figures from Abu Dhabi are positive. It suggests that they've managed to bring that number down by 500,000 a day. Now, I had to double check that because I was a bit like, does the maths work on that? And I think it does, to be fair. But it is still nevertheless quite an impressive number. However, there is a big question mark as to whether or not even these big plans are enough. I'm joined in the studio now by one man who's on a mission to reduce the amount of plastics, not just on land, but specifically in our oceans. He's going to tell us what he thinks about this issue. Toby Gregory recently returned from a row across the Atlantic Ocean, which he undertook with two other brave men, and that was in partnership with the UN Environment Programme's Clean Seas Initiative. And now he is back with a new drive to encourage people to take what he's calling the plastic pledge. Welcome to the studio, Toby Gregory.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's lovely to have you here. Tell me, what is the scale of the problem that we are facing? Why have you... Well, I'm going to get on to what the plastic pledge is in a media, but it sort of does what it says on the tin. But why is... What is the scale of the issue here?
Yeah, I think there are two things here. It's firstly, obviously, everyone's concerned about the environment and wants to do something. And I think we're all, through going to places that reducing their plastic consumption, believing, great, we're having an impact. But the issue continues. And, you know, when we cross the ocean, the whole way across, we saw large bits of plastic. The UN Environment Programme thought we'd only see small bits, and so we took a plankton net, which we've discussed before. But locally, the plastic issue hasn't been reduced. You know, there has been a significant impact with regards to the use of single-use plastic bags and other elements, but the single-use plastic goes much wider than just plastic bags.
Okay, so why are you specifically worried about the seas? Because I sort of don't get the disconnect. So I put my nasty plastic in the dustbin, and then I presume that then goes to landfill. Why is it getting into the sea?
Yeah, that's a great question. Between 60 and 90% of all plastic pollution on land ends up in the ocean. It's an incredible figure. I tend to use the 60% because we're on the safe side there, but common currency is around 90%, which is an incredible amount of plastic to make its way from land onto the ocean. So it's kind of bypassing the rubbish tips, it's bypassing the dumps and recycling plants, and that's a lot of it being discarded, you know, not properly discarded. And so consequently, it ends up in our oceans, and the oceans are vital. You know, they produce 50% of the oxygen we breathe. But it's not just that, it's the sea life. And, you know, there are staggering numbers in terms of number of fish and marine animals that have got plastics within them now. So actually, from a concern perspective regards to plastic, it's the amount that's going from land and ending up in the water.
Okay, so I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute, which is probably going to irritate you slightly. But the ocean is a very big place. And I have to admit, when I go to the beach here or I go in the sea here, I don't see huge amounts of plastic. I do see the occasional bit, and that is depressing. And, you know, people do organise beach cleanups and things. And actually, when we went on holiday to Sri Lanka recently, I saw a lot more there. And it is distressing to see that. But the ocean is so big. Does it not have the facility to absorb some of this plastic?
Yeah, the ocean wasn't designed to deal with our pollution. And so as a consequence, you know, when nation, you know, it was formed, however that was, you know, there was no process in place for, oh, this is a plastic bag or this is a piece of plastic. This is how we're going to deal with it. You know, it's man-made, it's synthetic. And as a consequence, it doesn't biodegrade easily. Again, the numbers vary, but they last well over 100 years. That's for sure. So as a consequence, there is no way for the water or the oceans to deal with it, with the exception of it being consumed by marine animals or certainly finding its way to the bottom of the ocean. So as a consequence, what we may not see necessarily on the shore locally, but if you travel around the world, and in fact, even to European countries, you'll see a lot of plastic on the beaches, a lot of plastic gathering, particularly at high and low tide when the markers change. So as a consequence, then you get to see quite how much plastic's in the ocean.
Okay, so now that I fully scrutinised the need for this plan, tell me a little bit more about how you are launching this plastic pledge, because I know it is very much your sort of trampolining off your previous adventure, which was when you rowed across the Atlantic.
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, the starting point was the row across the Atlantic, the partnership with the UN Environment Programme that led to a focus on plastics. And I think that the real changing point were two elements. One, the amount of plastic we saw. You know, we were expecting to see some, but just all the way across the whole ocean, we're 30 centimetres off the water. You know, if we can see that from there, what else is in the water? But there's another element to it. And actually, as we went to the other Emirates, as we stretched out across the UAE on holiday with the family, etc., seeing some of the plastic pollution there, both within the mountains and the desert and on the shorelines. So as a consequence, I was giving all these talks to multinationals, to local companies, to schools, and my remit from the UN was just to raise awareness. And actually, the awareness was great, but everyone was asking me, well, what can we do about it? And that's great, very positive, and people are taking action. But I think what's purposeful about the Plastic Pledge, which is what we've called this, fairly simple, but it's targeting entities. It's targeting entities that may not have something in place already, who want to do something but don't know how to. And there's an awful lot of them out there. In fact, of the three or four talks I give a week, at least 50% you know, don't know where to start. And what it relies on is a multiplier effect to those entities. So we're not asking them just to deal with their employees or change their own habits. The crux of the project focuses on what they can do with their ecosystem, what they can do with their partners. And we know it works already because I've had three phone calls from entities that are part of this whose partners have called up saying, okay, well, how do we get involved?
And so are you targeting, for example, factories that make plastic containers for food, or are you going for the sort of big plastic, not polluters, but the big plastic producers?
I'm going for companies that want to help. And that's the starting point. We kind of look at the attitude, the motivation and the commitment, because without any of those, nothing's going to move forward. And there's a range of companies that I was working with already, UD Trucks, Alma Sud, who almost pushed me towards this. You know, they were saying, okay, what can we do? How can we take a more active role in our community? What can we do to support our community, our stakeholders, and those sorts of things? So actually, in terms of who we're targeting, they're almost naturally occurring to date, because they're the ones that have come to us to say, what more can we do? How can we support our communities? What can we do about this? And how do we help take the lead? And both Alma Sud and UD Trucks and Safa Community School and JPS, you know, I have to almost run to keep up with them. Now, obviously, when you sign up to the pledge, there are a number of different parts involved. So it revolves a review after 2 months, 5 months and 9 months. And on 2 months, it says, you know, what have you done? Why have you done it? What's the impact of what you've done? Where's the evidence to suggest you've done that? And where's the evidence to back up that impact? And actually, what we do is then go to their community and say, look, this is what we've done. It wasn't an easy task, but we've managed it. And this was the result. Come with us on this journey. And again, we're only looking for 50 companies in the first year to sign up to the pledge. So it's not a numbers game for us, certainly in terms of who signs up. It's a numbers game in terms of the impact those sign up create.
Okay, so you are going to be holding these guys to account. They can't just go, yes, I sign up to the plastic pledge. I'm not going to use any plastic bags. And then you sort of quietly disappear and they just stick the badge on their window.
100%. You know, it'd be futile otherwise. Yeah. So it all starts with a plastic audit. You know, they have 8 to 10 weeks to complete the audit. It's a thorough audit. And then off the back of the audit, I just ask for 5 points. What 5 things are they going to do over the next 9 months that's going to make a difference? And then the clock starts ticking. And that's when their 2 months start. Then you get to the 5 months and the 9 months. And each time there's small reporting bits they have to do on 9 different sections. So it's fairly rigorous, but I didn't want it to be too onerous because otherwise nobody will do it. But this is where that attitude, motivation and commitment comes in. And that's why I focus on individual companies and only want 50. Because once you've got this positivity, once you start to see success, it's a bit like rowing the Atlantic. You know, once you start to take those small steps and you think that this is great. And then you move forward and it just starts to swell from there. And we, you know, today we wanted to launch on your show. And as a consequence, already we've had people reach out to us. How do I get involved? What is it? Can I do to make a difference?
Well, oddly enough, we're getting quite a lot of messages on the WhatsApp now. Toby, you're out there talking to people. You're out there talking to the multinationals. Do you think that there, as we build up towards COP28, that there is a sort of, I suppose, a momentum in the country that commercial entities, as well as the public sector, are looking to make a difference?
Yes, without question. And I think, you know, His Excellency, who's kind of leading COP, is doing an amazing job. And, you know, being very transparent with what they're saying, the challenge with COP globally is that everyone comes from a different perspective and a different viewpoint. So there's great momentum here. How do we share that momentum with the rest of the world?
Fantastic to have you on. Toby Gregory there. He is the initiator of the Plastic Pledge. You'll also have heard about him because he recently returned from a row across the Atlantic Ocean. Comments coming in. One person here says, which countries are responsible for disposing of their plastics into the ocean? Good question. Definitely something for us to look into. Unless, Toby, do you know?
Yeah, their own plastic pollution. The trouble is that people ship plastic pollution to other countries for them to deal with it. And then how do they dispose of it?
Also, David says the Abu Dhabi plastic ban has been incredibly good with a very noticeable effect. And Dubai's efforts under the direction of the Crown Prince of Dubai to remove single-use PET water bottles is equally amazing and needs to be recognised. Ben says restaurants make so much money on selling water, they're never going to voluntarily move away from selling bottles. And glass bottles are easily more expensive than plastic ones, thus reducing their profit. It's not going to happen unless it's mandated. Interesting words there, Ben. Thank you very much. Keep your comments coming. Please do join the conversation because we are discussing the problem of plastic waste on the programme today. That is 1 year after Abu Dhabi banned plastic bags. Worth mentioning a few top stats. 11 billion plastic bags used annually in the UAE. The Abu Dhabi plan has been a success. It's taken 500,000 bags out of the environment each day. But we've still got 11 million tonnes of plastic entering our seas every year, and that amount is projected to nearly triple by 2040. Right, half of all plastic produced is designed to be used only once and then thrown away. And one plastic bag takes at least 500 years to degrade. There you go. Those are the slightly depressing statistics. Thank you, Richard, for your message. He says, I work in a chemicals and plastics consulting industry. If you'd like some perspective, do get in touch. It'd be really interesting, actually, Richard, to hear about that from, you know, the inside of the market. Because I think it's important to emphasise that, you know, plastic, although it's seen as the enemy now, is you know, is what's used to keep our food clean and hygienic in order for it to be sold in supermarkets and things like that. Mohammed says they should definitely get rid of plastic bottles in restaurants and switch to large refillable bottles for each table. Mohammed, I can't disagree with you on that. That's a very good point. Etna, thank you for your message saying good luck, Toby. Everyone needs to get involved, but it must be a global solution. And there needs to be an effort from the big plastic producers. They do deserve credit as well because they are trying to fund and work on solutions. Etna's keen to get in touch with Toby. Toby Gregory, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now I'm going to cheer you up a bit because one fashion brand looking to make a dent in the plastic waste is Upfuse. They're a Cairo-based social enterprise. They're a slow fashion brand, and they create products by upcycling waste material into fabrics. A little earlier, I caught up with the co-founder, Yara Yassin, who told me what led her to set up the company.
So in 2013, it was a pre-master project of mine and my partner. It was a very early conversation about ethical fashion and environmental justice, but living in Egypt and being from the Middle East, it was very obvious that we have a lot of amazing resources that are going into dumps and landfills. And it was an obvious question, like, where does this go and who's taking care of it? And why are we consuming so much and no one is moderating or regulating all of this consumption? So we took this wise and we came up with this idea that maybe plastic is the most used product that we see all over the world and someone has to take an action. And we decided to create a product out of it because we are product designer already and we don't have any political power to stop it, neither any economical power to make it not part of the economy because, I mean, it's very simple. It's just a plastic bag, but there's huge money behind it. And there's a lot of people that work behind this product. And you cannot just simply go and close factories. So we had to find a way with the current solid waste to recycle it, upcycle it, and make the awareness in a beautiful sense. So users and consumers would think twice when they're getting something and using a single plastic bag that would last 30 seconds.
And so what are you actually using in your manufacture?
I mean, when we started, it was only plastic bags, but then we grew into more upcycling of plastics in general. So our bags is made from upcycled plastic bags. Our clothing is made from upcycled plastic bottles, which in the clothing comes the recycled polyester. And our footwear is made from recycled car tires.
Is it difficult to do this?
I mean, everything in the start, especially if you're starting without reference, is very difficult. I had to say that since 2013 all the way to 2017, we've dedicated our time. We haven't worked anything else but experimenting in different workshops and our own workshops and collaborating with any industry that could be like-minded. With the car tires, we would go to mechanics that would repair cars and wheels so we would understand the know-how of how they repair things, how they cut, you know. And for plastic bottles, the same. It wasn't easy at all till we've created a manual of upcycling plastic waste that we later on have used to expand and make our project a business that is empowering people, and it's a successful one that now we are operating in Egypt, in Germany, and now in the UAE.
Okay, so it's clearly a brilliant initiative, but fashion is very fickle and ultimately you need people to buy your products, however green and however environmentally friendly they are. How are you attracting your customers? Who are your customers?
So our customers, they're young people. They're from almost 18 to 35. We have a very large group of customers, which is very interesting. Everyone would think that we're only focusing on vegan, green movement enthusiasts, but actually no, because of the high quality of the product and the high aesthetics of the products, we attract different people that would want a bag initially and want something different and looks different and durable with reasonable prices. And at the end of the day, it's also giving a statement because not a lot of people are wearing this bag, especially that each of the bags that we have is one of a kind in terms of colors. So it's unique and it gives back to the environment and it gives back to community.
Can I get a little bit more into that community idea? Are you also manufacturing the clothes and the shoes and the bags in an ethical way?
Yes, certainly. I mean, if you want to give back to the environment, you have to give back to the people that live in this environment. And due to the geographic location where we are, we work with communities in Egypt where we welcome very much refugees, immigrants, and also people from underprivileged communities in Egypt. We focus 100% on women, and we try to empower the woman in a realistic, rational way. And from Upfuse, we felt like the only way to support women and give back is actually to give them skills and vocational trainings, and then would end up into jobs that would give them financial independence. And this is something I really appreciate, because they were the pioneers that when me and my founder were like, we want to create this crazy material and do this crazy bag. We were only accepted by women like who wants to try, who really need to learn something so they can have an income. And now they're the experts.
As far as the raw materials, is there any shortage? Do you find it easy to get these materials to then recycle?
Unfortunately, there's no any shortage. We have a lot. And we work with a lot of corporates and international organizations from all over the world that want to donate their excess waste so we can upcycle and create products for them.
That is Yara Yassin. She is the co-founder of the company Upfuse. Now, they are responsible for recycling plastics into bags and clothes and also shoes. They use the old tyres in shoes. Fantastic enterprise. Really interesting to hear there how you can repurpose all this plastic waste.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now, you might remember that Dubai's Road and Transport Authority has published its plan to achieve net zero emission public transport in the country by 2050, or at least in the Emirate by 2050. Over the coming years, the RTA plans to decarbonise all its taxis, limos and public buses. The organisation also aims to minimise its carbon footprint in its buildings and waste management plants. Basically, the gist is that it's going to save 10 million tonnes of carbon dioxide emissions, but it's also going to save money up to 3.3 billion dirhams. A little earlier this morning, we wanted to find out a little bit more about the details on this, because the RTA is such a massive organisation here in Dubai. It's also responsible for a lot of the mega projects. So Jennifer Crichton sat down with Nada Jassim, who is Director of Safety, Risk, Regulation and the Planning Department. And she began by asking her about the ultimate aim of these plans.
The strategy is aiming to decarbonize public transportation, which is buses and the supporting taxis and limousine. But also it will also aim to decarbonize the infrastructure that is supporting the operation of this public transportation. For example, the office building that I'm currently sitting in, the different infrastructure that are run and operated by RTA to support the smooth and safe operation of the infrastructure of the public transportation, that will also be decarbonized part of this strategy.
Now, obviously, as in addition to those offices, that the main bulk of this strategy relates to the vehicles. And how expensive is it going to be to make that move to non-fossil fuel using vehicles?
So one of the key challenges at the current time for transforming to decarbonized technologies is the availability of this technology and how suitable this technology to be operated in our harsh environment, specifically with our increased heat and humidity, as well as the dust in the environment. So what we are trying to do here in this strategy is not just to keep this strategy at a stagnant stage to depend on what we have currently available in the market, but we are collaborating with private partner, with technology developers, to assure that we continuously evolve and enhance our technological spectrum of available tools to enhance the current vehicles and the buses that we have. For example, in our strategy, we are aiming to have zero emission of public buses by 2050. And slowly we are introducing electric and hydrogen buses in our public transportation fleet. Currently, we have already completed multiple trials for electric buses, and that gives us a very good basis and a background of how we can further add and enhance our fleet with electric buses, etc.
You mentioned hydrogen there. You're looking at a combination, yes, then, are you, of hydrogen and electric buses? And how is that going to work in terms of the proportions and the timescales?
So far, electric vehicles are the most available sustainable mode of transportation. But we are also aiming to have the hydrogen-operated vehicles in our public transportation buses, as well as taxis and limo vehicles. So we are aiming to have a proportion between 70-30 between electric and hydrogen. And the reason we are introducing and we are assuring that hydrogen has a significant proportion in our strategy because we believe it is the future after electric transportation. And it is a cleaner source of energy, much more cleaner also than the electric energy generated by fossil fuel. Of course, if the hydrogen is green hydrogen. So the aim is that to have 30% of the vehicles in the strategy to be hydrogen vehicles. Again, we do know now that current state, it's not yet available in a commercial scale for implementation at a larger fleet. However, we have full confidence that as technology evolved for electric vehicles, as you notice, Jennifer, now we have a lot of electric vehicles you see in the road and they are available, like, you know, which was something a bit rare to see 4 or 5 years ago. Now it is very much available. So the same will evolve also with larger scale vehicles like buses for both electric and hydrogen. And this is how this introduction will take its place. And hopefully it will take its percentage in the fleet population.
What role does the metro have to play in this picture? Because obviously moving to a sustainable public transport network, we're not just looking at the roads, are we?
Exactly. The good news is the metro is already operating on a clean source of fuel, which is electric energy. It is also helping our, not just our zero emission strategy, but also our autonomous transportation strategy, because our metro is driverless. So the metro is already passed and exceeded the strategy requirement many years ago.
Now, you mentioned autonomous vehicles there. You've got targets there in addition to these zero emissions targets. The big picture of that combined is a very ambitious one in terms of targets. Is it realistic? Are you optimistic about it?
So that's a very good question, Jennifer. So in this strategy, we are aiming to stagger the targets across the years, starting from now all the way to 2050. So we are not aiming to do everything by the end of 2050, and you're not aiming to achieve everything by the coming 5 or 10 years. What we are hoping for is that we have, for example, for zero emission taxis and limousine, that will be accomplished by 2040. And then for the energy used by buildings, to have near zero energy buildings, that will be by 2045. And hopefully during that, once we start the introduction of electric buses and hydrogen in the fleet, that will be accomplished by 2050.
Nada Jassim there from the RTA. Right, welcome back to the show. Such an exciting new project to talk about on the radio today. Well, it's sort of a new project, but and it sort of isn't, because exciting new plans were revealed overnight to show that the Palm Jebel Alley is officially going to be developed by Nakheel. Now, it's a mega project because it's twice an area the size of Palm Jumeirah. It's going to include 80 hotels and resorts, green spaces. There'll also be other leisure and retail amenities. They're going to be spanning in total the length of that palm, which is 13.4 square kilometres. The project's going to add about 110 kilometres of coastline to Dubai, and it'll offer beachside living to 35,000 families. It sounds like it's going to be a luxe project. Dubai Media Office have described it as an aspirational residential destination in the city. There's going to be mixed use walkable neighborhoods, they said. It's also going to incorporate smart city technologies and, intriguingly, up to 30% of the Palm Jebel Alley's energy requirements will be obtained from renewable sources. So no further information released on that, but lots of details for us to get our teeth into. And joining me now to talk through those plans is Christopher Seymour, who is the Managing Director of the consultancy. They're the construction consultancy, Mott MacDonald Middle East. Chris, thanks for coming in again. You're becoming a regular on the sofa.
No problem at all. Pleased to be here.
Great to have you here. Now, obviously, this project's been shelved for a while. Exciting to have it come back. How does this feed into the sort of master plan of Dubai's development?
And I think this is a really good story for Dubai, because it's, as some of the Dubai veterans will remember, it was stopped in 2009 during the global financial crisis, along with actually the waterfront development, which is actually sort of the inland part of the Palm. So I guess newcomers to Dubai may be forgiven for wondering where it is, because you can't actually actually see it from the main road there, but it is literally the seaward side of that waterfront development on the right-hand side as you go out past Jebel Ali. So it's really exciting to see this project is coming back. Good story for Dubai because it just shows that shelved projects, which sometimes has to happen because of economic conditions, can come back. And so I think that's a good story from this perspective. Very much part of the 2040 plan. Don't forget, we've got those five hubs around Dubai. So we've got Dera and Bir Dubai. We've got Business Bay going across to Silicon Oasis with technology, Expo, and then back around to Marina and Jumeirah. This is a separate part of it, but it is still part of that plan. But I think it's wrong to think this is just a real estate play. This is definitely something that's part of the D33, that economic agenda to double Dubai's economy by 2033. So it's very much interlinked with that. So it's not just about real estate. It's very much involved in the whole Dubai story.
Is that why they're putting such a focus on tourism? You know, this mention of 80 hotels and resorts. So not just real estate. They're not just selling flats and home and villas to people, but they actually want to make it a business hub, an economic producer, ultimately.
That's right. And I think that side of it, the link with tourism and residential, is probably quite similar to Palm Jumeirah. That's the Crescent. The Crescent there is full of hotels, and I expect we'll see the same thing in Palm Jebel Ali. But but it also points to more mixed use. So we're probably going to see maybe a bit more blend with some commercial space there. I'm sure we're going to start seeing retail space there. But I think there may also be a little bit more of a blend with more commercial usage there. Talks around the much more of a green agenda, I think, physically green agenda around trees and parks and walkable spaces, probably to a far higher degree than on Palm Jumeirah. Of course, nowadays people say, oh, I live on the palm. Soon you're going to have to say which palm you actually live on. So it's quite exciting from that perspective.
So I've got two questions coming out of that. First of all, there's mention here of 30% of the energy requirements coming from renewable sources. Do you think that's just likely means that they're going to be getting their electricity from solar? Or do you think it's possible that they might have a whole new type of generating power out there on the palm, you know, tidal or wind or anything kind of new and fun and sexy?
That's a really interesting question. If we look back at the 2040 plan, that has already commits to that amount of renewables across Dubai by 2040. And don't forget, by 2050, 100% of energy capacity will be clean energy. So it's consistent with that. However, there are in the announcement, there are signs that there could also be some smart infrastructure, which may also include some actually on-site generation. It may include tidal, probably not wind power. That's not really an optimized source of power in the UAE. There's not that consistency of wind is not really there to make that economically viable. But certainly, I expect we will be seeing quite a bit of usage of rooftops for solar power, without a doubt.
Okay, now I remember I came out to Dubai for the first time ever about a decade ago, and we stayed in the Palm Tree Court in Jebel Ali. And I remember looking out at the coast and going, but what's that? And why is it there? And now, finally, a decade later, it's going to be developed. Will some of the structures that are already there have been eroded, degraded, ultimately, because they've been sat there for so long?
Most of the structures that are there are steel and concrete, extremely resilient materials. However, in the normal way, there would definitely be some due diligence around those. And sometimes the building code and engineering code actually moves on, which sometimes means that there needs to be some renewal in that respect. So that would be a normal way of re-energizing a development. There has to be that investigation into the existing engineering structures. Nikhil, always very good at keeping records. So the records are going to be there of what was built, how it was built, and the loads that were expected to be taken. But it's important to always undertake that. So that's something that's ongoing, if you like, in the engineering community at the moment. I think it's also worth mentioning, and some people ask me this, is why is it another palm shape? Because Palm Jumeirah is a palm and this is a palm. There's that obvious local context of a palm tree. So it would be shaped like that. But it is also a very convenient shape which maximizes waterfront distance. And it's very difficult, apart from that shape, to get the maximum waterfront within a reasonably compact shape. So it's talking about 110 kilometers extra. waterfront is the most valuable and the most desirable real estate. And so that's the there's method behind the image. It's not just about the image of the palm.
Yeah, I can imagine. Also, you're much cooler when you're on the water. I feel like there's at least a 5 degrees difference from, you know, inland to when you're actually by the beach. How about the fact that this is, of course, is it reclaimed land? It's just claimed land, isn't it? Do you think there's any suggestion that some of the fronds might have been eroded away? Do you think that the sand might need to be bolstered again?
Sometimes that is definitely the case. So this is, this was land that was created. It wasn't, they would call it reclaimed land. It's marine dredged aggregate mainly. And again, that goes on with the normal checks. My view is, I think that the rumours that there's been erosion of not just this palm but also the World Island are probably overstated, if I'm honest. But even so, in gearing up a development of this size, it would be absolutely natural to undertake some of those marine investigations just to make sure there hasn't been any movement or erosion of those of the aggregate away from the structure. It's a very critical part. And so there's no doubt that'll be taking place. Slightly different shape to the Palm Jumeirah. It's literally the crescent is a drive on, drive off crescent, whereas a Palm Jumeirah is very much you come to the end of the crescent, you pretty much got to drive back. This is slightly different shape. So it's not only is it longer and bigger, it's slightly different in shape as well.
I think it's more convenient because I find it really annoying when you get to the end of the crescent, you have to drive 45 minutes back, especially when the traffic's bad. So I prefer this palm. How soon do you think we could start seeing things being built on it? It's all very well to say 80 hotels and resorts, but I mean, is the first one going to be there in 2 years? What do you reckon?
This is a long-term project. There's no doubt about it. If we think about when Palm Jumeirah was started, there are still vacant plots there now that need to be. So its first phase of development is just coming to that end. So that you're probably talking about there's a couple of decades of work at least there, which is good for the economy because it's not just one hit and it goes. And it also enables the development itself to ride across what will be inevitable waves in the real estate market. It's not always going to be increasing as it is now, and it's going to go through some waves, as naturally all markets do. So I think that longer term prospect of this development, because it is so large, again, is something very strong for Dubai. It's not just going to be all over in 5 years at all. I would suggest this is a couple of decades there, but I expect we'll be seeing some activity soon.
Very exciting stuff. Chris Seymour, as always, fantastic to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for outlining all those details, putting it in context. Really brilliant to have you in. So thanks for your
time. Thank you very much.
It's been great.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to the show. Now, the Crown Prince of Jordan, Hussein bin Abdullah, will marry fiancé Rajwa Al Saif today in Amman. Now, the bride is Saudi and celebrations have already begun in both countries. It is going to be one of the biggest or the highest profile events in Jordan for, commentators are suggesting it's about 2 decades. And it is creating a real buzz, not just in Jordan, but in the region. I mean, we really are getting wall-to-wall coverage. State television in Jordan says that the wedding will be attended by, and I quote, heads of state and crown princes and figures from friendly and brotherly countries. We know that the US First Lady Jill Biden is going to be there. She's already arrived in the country. Rumour has it that UK royals, Swedish royals, all sorts of royals are going to be there. Joining me now to talk through the importance of the event, not just for the happy couple, but also for the country Jordan, is Azama Al-Sharif. He is a veteran journalist and a political commentator based in Amman. And the fact that we've got a political commentator on to talk about a royal wedding gives you a sense of how important this whole process is for the country and for the region. Azama, thank you so much for joining me on the line. How are you?
I'm fine, Georgie. Good morning.
Good morning to you. How is this wedding being viewed in Amman, in Jordan? Obviously, you're there now.
Well, it's a festive occasion, of course, and for Jordanians, the majority of Jordanians, this is something that they have not gone through before. It's important to know that almost 60% of Jordanians are below the age of 30. So for them, this is something that they have never experienced before. It rejuvenates the monarchy itself as such. The last time we had such a huge occasion was the coronation of King Abdullah and Queen Rania in 1999. The Last time we had a major royal wedding was in 1993 when Prince Abdullah married Princess Rania. So it's a continuation of a tradition, but more importantly, it focuses attention on Jordan as a thriving monarchy, as a country that is surviving in a very turbulent area as well. And the fact that we have so many dignitaries, heads of state, royalties coming to participate in this in this occasion underlines the importance of the country and how well positioned it is in terms of its relationship to the rest of the world, not only in the region, but to the West, to international community as well.
We get a sense of continuity thanks to this wedding, because of course the Crown Prince Hussein will potentially, well, or to all intents and purposes, will one day be king. So in many ways we're seeing the marriage of the future king and queen here.
Oh, definitely. You have to remember Crown Prince Hussein, when he becomes king in the future, he represents the fifth generation of Hashemites continuously, who ruled Jordan since the 1920s, and this is a testament to the buoyancy and the fact that Jordan has survived. You have to look at the region, world wars, wars with Israel, influxes of refugees. There were many analysts and pundits who wrote Jordan off many times. And this occasion proves him wrong.
It is very encouraging, certainly, for the continuity of the country, for the security of the country. Why do you think it's important regionally? Is it to do with the fact that the bride is Saudi?
Well, this has something to do with it. But I think there is a tendency in the Arab world to politicize everything, unfortunately. But we have to remember, these are young couple, Western educated. Both were educated in the United States. They met at different occasions. They fell in love. It's just like any other normal people, normal couples. So we have to focus on that more than the fact that she is Saudi. And you have to remember that in the family, the Hashemites, his grandfather, King Hussein, the late King Hussein, married outside the immediate family. His first wife was British, and his second wife was from Egyptian descent, and his third wife was from a Palestinian descent. So that the fact that he's married from the Saudi, prominent Saudi family, for that matter, is important. But let's focus on the fact that there are two lovebirds, and they are in love, and they are showing that kind of happiness in Jordan. It shows in the fact that his father, King Abdullah, is so happy. Yesterday, he hosted a huge party. 4,000 people attended, and he talked. He spoke as a father, not as a king, and it was very, very heart-moving. Same thing with his mother, Queen Rania. She hosted a beautiful henna party in a traditional way about a week ago, and invited people from all walks of life from Jordan. And that also showed that she was acting more as a mother rather than a queen at that moment. So this is a family occasion, and the extended family is Jordan. And more than that, those people who are coming to participate are friends of Jordan, people who love the country and admire the country.
I have to say, there's nothing like a royal wedding to create a real glow around the country. We had it ourselves in the United Kingdom a few years ago with Prince Harry and Meghan, and certainly there was a real flurry around the country as a consequence. So I wish all Jordanians the very best on this very happy occasion. Azama, thank you so much for joining me on the studio. That is on the line, rather. That's Azama Al-Sharif. He's a veteran journalist and a political commentator based in Amman. We really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Yes, welcome back. 1st of June, and at the start of every month, we are here on The Agenda, like to get your diary organised. Basically, tell you what you can get up to around town. And as ever, there is no shortage of events in Dubai this summer. To tell us more, joining us now is Alreem Al-Raida. She's an executive for leisure events and festivals at the Department of Economy and Tourism. She's in charge of the Dubai calendar. Joins me now on Teams. Hi, Alreem. Good to see you. How are you?
Hi, Georgia. I'm good. It's always good to be back on your show.
Oh, it's fantastic to have you with us, particularly now when, frankly, there's not as much to do outdoors as we'd like because it's all got a bit hot. So instead, we're all going indoors and you've got lots to entertain us instead, haven't you?
Oh, 100%. Always, Georgia. Always something to do in Dubai. So just before I get started with all the events that are taking place, I just need to remind everyone listening that, you know, again, there's so much taking place in the city and way too many for me to mention them all right now. So just a reminder for everyone to constantly check DubaiCalendar.com for all the upcoming events around the city.
Yeah, there's loads to see there. I have the app on my phone. Tell me first up about the musical events, because there's some real stars coming into town, aren't there?
Yeah, so many stars, so many performances that will be taking place in Dubai. The main one that I would absolutely need to highlight is the Sleeping Beauty show. So that's taking place at Dubai Opera tomorrow and Saturday. It will basically be a ballet show and then a fairy tale performance based on the story of Sleeping Beauty. And I think, Georgia, let's be real. I think most of us are Sleeping Beauty fans, whether kids or adults. So this show is definitely a beautiful showcase of it. And it's, I think, a must go to.
Yeah, it really is. Heaven.
Yeah, 100%. We also have a tribute to Adele show, which is also a fun one to go to. I mean, again, for everyone listening, if you're a fan of Adele, which I think pretty much everyone is, then you definitely enjoy this one. It's a 90-minute tribute showcase of a lot of Adele's popular songs and tracks, and that's taking place on the 9th and the 10th of June. So it's just, you know, a perfect opportunity to just enjoy a night out of beautiful music. There's one more that I want to highlight, the trio Arab Beats. They will be performing at Coca-Cola Arena on the 16th of June. So that's featuring Silaway, Big Sam and Muslim. I think they're very well known in the region here. So they're all coming together and they will be performing for the very first edition of Arab Beats, of them as a trio together, basically.
Yeah,
so that's a good one as well.
That is very good. We've also got Tom, Adele and separately Mick Hucknall also coming to the Coca-Cola Arena on the 9th of June. They are names from, I suppose, Western music. They're names from my sort of cultural background and well worth a watch. They're both very popular indeed. How about comedy events?
Yeah, so comedy, we have the Self-Drive Laughter Factory, which is the UAE's longest running comedy night. And that's coming back on the 16th of June. You know, honestly, there's nothing better than comedy shows. It really is such a nice way to spend the night. And then in terms of the comedians who will be participating, all their names will be on DubaiCalendar.com. So I do encourage everyone to check out the comedians that will be participating in the comedy night.
And you wouldn't expect there to be sport during the summer, at least not spectator sports, but there are two big events coming in June, aren't there?
Yeah, so I absolutely need to highlight the World Paddle League. That's taking place on the 8th to the 11th of June in Coca-Cola Arena. So yes, it's quite hot, but it's a perfect venue, which is going to be indoor in Coca-Cola Arena. So there's going to be 24 top-rated players from all around the globe who will be coming to Dubai to compete. And then also after the games, there will be some A-list artists who will be putting on performances and concerts. And some names include Simply Red and DJ Nicky Romero. And honestly, Georgia, I just need to highlight to everyone how much fun paddle games are to watch. Even if you're not a paddle player, I think everyone needs to experience the World Paddle League this year.
It's very fast.
So that's definitely a fun one.
Yeah, it's very fast moving, isn't it? It's a sort of, you don't get bored because there's just so much going on and everyone moves around very quickly. And oddly enough,
100%.
I like the combination there of sport and music. Last year, we actually went to a tennis tournament. Was it as much as last year? Maybe it wasn't that long ago, 6 months ago, maybe even. We went to an event at the Coca-Cola Arena, which was a tennis tournament followed by a concert. And it just worked really well. The combination was awesome. It took up about 5 hours of your day, and just the two things, you know, you got to sit and watch and enjoy the sport, and then you got to dance around. It was a really good combo.
Exactly, it's the perfect combo, I would have to say.
And how about the esports and gaming festival? Something that my children have already spotted on your calendar.
Yes, so that's definitely a fun one for, I think, everyone in the city. So that's coming back from the 21st to the 25th of June, and it will be taking place at the Dubai Exhibition Center at Expo City Dubai. Basically, the festival is just a celebration of video games and the gaming industry. There's going to be some amazing games, activities, challenges. There's going to be talks from industry professionals, tournaments. There's a cosplay competition, and so much more. And then for schools specifically, there will be lots of school tournaments. There's going to be a really fun cosplay themed dress up day. There's going to be educational workshops. Professionals from the industry will be coming down to the schools and giving talks. So overall, the whole city will be talking about gaming and the gaming industry. It's just a fun one. It's a great event and festival. So I definitely do encourage everyone listening to take part in the festival.
Yeah, it's Yes, it's a good way to get down there and see what all the fuss is about, because I think esports is still quite a new concept to most of us, although the kids get it immediately. Alreem, as always, fantastic to have you join us on the line. Thank you very much for filling up our calendars for June. We'll be sure to have you back in another 28 days so you can sort out our July for us. That was Alreem Al-Raida. She is from Dubai Tourism. She's in charge of the Dubai calendar there and very good at coming up with things for us to do.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Hello there, welcome back to the show. And it is our chance to catch up with the team from The Reboot, which of course is the tech show, the exceptional tech show that goes out every single Saturday at 10 a.m.
It goes out at 12, but close.
I knew I was close. Did you hear the pause?
Yeah. I could hear you trying. Yeah. I should have done you the favor and just filled in really quickly.
But I get it right every other time. I don't know why I've gone off on a curve. It's Motomania that's on at 10 every other Saturday. Yeah. But you guys are every Saturday at midday. Sonal Rapani, the voice you've just heard. Also very recognizable, of course, from Offscript. Every Thursday she comes in a bit early to tell us about what she's been talking about on the program. Well, what's your topic recently?
Well, recently, last week, we were looking into AI in healthcare, because we're talking about generative AI and how it's being used from just a workplace point of view a lot. But when it comes to healthcare, there's some really interesting moves that are happening. And a headline that caught our eyes, Zina and I, who works on the show with me, was the fact that there was a team from McMaster University and MIT that discovered a new antibiotic that can be used to kill a deadly superbug. Now, we hear about superbugs being one of the biggest challenges facing healthcare. They're antibiotic resistant oftentimes, and there's a real kind of fear around that. They kind of managed to take a look at a bunch of molecules and compounds and have them screened by this AI system and eventually tested a couple hundred to end up with 9 that they thought would work. So it was just a really streamlined process that would have taken, you know, thousands of man hours of people sitting with their test tubes and checking things through microscopes, just being screened through AI. It was a very efficient process. So we thought we'd get into this a little bit. And we were joined in studio this past Friday by Brian Date Francesca. Now, he's an expert in AI and healthcare. He's also executive director of Thumbe University Hospitals Complex. And oftentimes when we talk about AI, the first question, Georgia, that you ask somebody or that I would ask somebody typically is it going to take all the jobs? That seems to be the big fear. That seems to be the big question. And he's like, why is that the first question? Shouldn't the first question be, how is this going to benefit patients? I'm like, yeah, actually, there's a point there. And he pointed out that there are certain areas we're already seeing a lot of this. Diagnostic imaging, for one. AI is already, he said, able to surpass the accuracy of diagnosing certain diseases over humans' ability. Another example that he gave me is in hyper-individualized treatment, especially with some certain diseases that are hard to detect.
A little girl, a very sick little girl named Mila Vitarello, by age 6, she had seen 100 physicians. Because she was sick. She was very sick, and no one could figure out what was wrong with her. Eventually, she met with a Harvard physician, a Harvard doctor, who, for the first time, used an AI model to analyze her gene profile and her medical records. This model then diagnosed that she had a very rare disease called Batten's disease. They then were able to develop a drug unique and specific for her. This is referred to as hyper specialization.
That was the voice there of Brian DeFrancesca. He is an expert in AI and healthcare. And really quickly, there's another example right here in the UAE that we covered as well. In Silico, it's a company that's based in Abu Dhabi, and they're using generative AI to develop medicines. So just to provide some context, this is what they told us. Usually a medicine is going to take 10 years to develop, about 1.5 to 2 billion US dollars. Let that settle in for a second, just to develop a single medicine. And then 90% will fail in clinical trials. Wow. So that's why when you think about pharma, it's such a big industry, right? Now, they claim that they can accelerate the medicine discovery process by threefold and make it up to 50 times cheaper potentially. So Zena caught up with Alex Alaper, who's the president of this company in silico, and he explained how they're making the approach a bit more efficient.
We use generative AI to discover idea about the target. Once we identify a target in a certain disease, we use generative AI again to design this molecule that would modulate this target and potentially cure the disease. Everything is done computationally at this stage, right? So it's in a cloud or, you know, on your cluster on a laptop, because you can run our models pretty much anywhere. When you kind of zoom in on the molecule, you generated a molecule, you need to test it. When we identify this molecule, we use our facilities in China. So in China, we have a huge drug R&D team that focuses specifically on taking those molecules generated by AI and making them, so synthesize, doing chemical synthesis, so making real molecules and testing them. We have our fully automated robotics lab, which can facilitate for testing.
The voice there of Alex Alaper, president of InSilico, which is making drugs using AI. So very interesting prospects for the world of healthcare and medicine. And once again, you know, when we talk about jobs, Alex said, we're not replacing people. This is just going to be a tool that they're using. That's typically the line that we hear. But of course, potentially what that means, it makes it more efficient, faster and cheaper.
It's so important, I think, to sort of bridge the gap here, because we've heard so many sort of doom-mongering AI stories that I think it's important to emphasize the benefits as well of the new tech.
And I kind of buy into both sides of that. I think they can both be true at once. You know, I think there are benefits clearly, but I get the doom-mongering because personally my view on this is capitalism wins. Yep. And we know when it comes to capitalism, people will make their choices maybe not based on ethics or the best of humanity. So I get both sides. So it's important to see both, I think.
So much more tech news to talk about this Saturday. I mean, it really is one of the best times for this program to launch. So tune in for midday, the reboot, every Saturday, hosted by the fabulous Sonal Rupani. And if you miss it, you can have it this afternoon as well, can't you?
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? You can check out our podcast as well. This weekend, we are going to be having a biohacker on, somebody who's claiming that he can live to 150. So if you are into that space or you're curious about that, tune in.
The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.